Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
And we are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone, and our guest right now is Father Ronald Rollheiser. He's an oblate priest, he's a theologian, a popular spirituality writer, and the author of the upcoming book, The Passion and the Cross. So if you would like to join the conversation with Father Rollheiser, if you want to tell us a little bit about your experience of sort of what he was describing earlier about this life and death, these moments when it all kind of seems to happen at once, these symbols of our faith in a sense, you can give us a call at 1-888-3-CATHOLIC, 1-888-322-8465. Or if you have any questions for Father Rollheiser, you can give us a call. Father Ronald Rollheiser, I have a question for you. So in the article you wrote for America and in your book, you write about another symbol. Before, we talked about this blood and this wine that come from Jesus' side, but you also write about this moment at Jesus' death when the veil of the sanctuary is torn in two. And I think a lot of people, and you point this out, see this as a kind of destructive act. But it's another symbol of that closeness of Christ and his people. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yes, thanks. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they describe that the minute of Christ's death, and they see he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. And they're very careful to see that he, that it was something that he did, right. They're emphasizing that he's God in man. But then they say immediately after, they say then the curtain veil was ripped from top to bottom, and there was an earthquake, and the graves began to open up. And see, when you hear that, remember hearing it as a child and so on, but even here, you automatically think, now that they realize what they've done, they've crucified an innocent person, all this dark, apocalyptic imagery. But actually, it's a beautiful imagery. And what the curtain veil was, the veil in the Jewish temple that separated the ordinary people from seeing into the Holy of Holies. And only the priests could go behind there. And the idea was there's an aura, there's a sacredness in behind this. And when the evangelists say he ripped the veil from top to bottom, says what the crucifixion does is it tears away the veil that separates us ordinary people from looking into the real Holy of Holies, which is God's heart, the Trinity. And, as I point out in the article, you want to catch the contrast by going back to the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, and the image of the rainbow. See, what the rainbow does, we say, God is light. That's an interesting expression. God is light, but, you never see light. We see by light. There's light in my room right now as I'm talking to you. I can't see light, but I see because of light. See, we don't see God except with light in one instance. If you bring a prism into a room, the prism refracts the light and breaks it so you see the inside of light, which are the seven basic colors. And the inside of light is spectacularly beautiful, but you normally don't see it. So in a way, a prism tears away the temple veil so you see the inside. But what the evangelists are trying to tell us is with the cross becomes a prism that tears away the veil, and you see the moral heart of God, the way a rainbow shows you the physical beauty of light, what's inside of light. The cross shows you the moral, spiritual beauty that's inside of the Trinity. And then I try to, in the book, to try to spell out all those points. What is the moral beauty inside the Trinity? But it's a powerful and a wonderful metaphor.
Yeah, indeed, indeed it is. And what is the role of the resurrection in this? As you wrote in America, the disciples felt something flow out of Jesus' death that made them feel freer, less guilty, and more open to life than ever before. But they understood that death in light of the resurrection, right? So how do you understand that?
Well, in terms of this, see, when this was actually, of course, the Gospels are written many years after this, so the way the Gospels write up the cross and the Passion it's already viewed through the lens of the resurrection.
Right, you know? Right.
When it actually happened, first of all, most of the apostles were scared and they were in hiding. You know? You had, the fidelity of women. They were under the cross.
Right.
not the men. And, when they experienced Christ's death at the time, they experienced it as a complete ending, as a complete darkness, as complete, terminality, you know. And then the resurrection just absolutely reversed everything, you know.
Mm.
See, and then they began to understand in their gut, and they put it into metaphor about the Lamb of God and washing of blood. They began to understand that precisely the point I was trying to make earlier with passivity, we kind of get it that somehow the way Jesus died and the way he gave this over, it's actually giving them life. It's actually making it's washing away their sins and so on. And again, these things, Matt, they sound so abstract.
Right.
But, if you've ever lost my parents, both of them, when I was 21 years old. I had great parents. It took about 2 years. All of a sudden, I realized that as sad as that was, something powerful. They're able to give me more after they died than they gave me when they were alive. You just feel that. So these things, there, you get them in your gut. They're abstract, but actually, you experience this.
No, I think
sure
that
you both experience people close to you die. Very sad at the time. Later on, there's a flow of life that comes from them.
It's interesting you should say that because my mom died when I was a boy, and there is a way in which she's more present to me today than she might have been had she actually lived. And the journey through that process of mourning, that kind of journey from our own Fridays to Sundays, is that journey from experiencing people just as an absence to experiencing them as a presence. So I understand just what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is there's a negative side to it. You have to behave yourself. My parents are present to me right now. I can't get away with anything. If they were alive, if I was 2,000 miles away, I was in good shape.
Right, right, right. That's exactly right. But we also get echoes of that same sense of freedom, of feeling less guilty, more open to life from the sacraments, don't we? I mean, I think of, that feeling that you get when you're walking out of a church after Mass, where you're just a bit more open to life, or that feeling that you have walking out of the confessional, where there's a little spring in your step and you feel like the weight of the world has been lifted off you.
Very much so. It's interesting the way in Roman Catholicism, we've always interpreted down the line that the blood and water is baptism, the Eucharist, and penance, that the blood and water is the sacraments. And it's true. It works like that. First of all, it's a more primary symbol. It's a symbol of birth, a symbol of being washed clean and life. But then it becomes the sacraments. The sacraments are really the way some of that blood and water is flowing out today. And like you said, you experience that. I've been going to confession since I've been 6 years old, and I still can't walk away from a confession and not feel some freedom. Like you said, a new spring in your step.
Right. And these sacraments, I think, really help us in that freedom to help others carry their own crosses, to help support each other in their own struggles, in their own sort of small moments of living and dying throughout life. And you write in your book, you bring up the phrase, when you carry somebody's cross, don't send him or her the bill. We have to do this freely and without resentment, you write, so that it's not this sense of holding ourselves up or holding something over somebody's head, but truly participating in the suffering of others at times and helping people out along the way.
Yeah. In fact, Carrie, that little expression about, which I got from a nun in spiritual direction once, an elder, it's a wonderful expression. She said, if you carry somebody's cross, don't send them the bill, because if you send them the bill, the cross doesn't do the work anymore. The cross, where Jesus' cross sets us free, or love sets us free precisely when it isn't manipulative, when it hasn't got a price tag, when it is what love needs to be, which is gratuity and altruism. And so, we all do this sometimes, where we do hard things, but unconsciously or in some subtle way we're sending a bill. Say, look what I've done for you, and you better be grateful. But it also, then it, the life doesn't flow because there's a price tag. When you read the Gospels, you could take the word right through just the word gratuitous, gracious, grace. It's the coloring through the entire Gospel. When you take that word away, everything collapses, There right. can't be a bill.
Right, exactly.
There isn't a quid pro quo here. It's something that's really utterly gratuitous.
Yeah.
Right.
But, that's what we have to do in our lives.
Right.
Who was it? Kierkegaard, a great quote where Kierkegaard says, Jesus doesn't want admirers. Jesus needs people to imitate that, to follow, And so, the cross, and I try to bring it, it's not something that, first of all, we should admire. So isn't it wonderful Jesus died for us?
Right.
It's something we've got to incarnate and keep doing.
And it's interesting because, sometimes I'll be talking with folks who maybe are fallen away Christians or they're not Christians, and they say, I admire your faith, Father, but, I think Jesus was a great teacher, but I don't think that he was who you say he was or is. And I always say, that's okay. You don't, obviously, we don't compel people to believe these things. But the reason why, I do is, A, I inherited it as a gift, but B, it's hard for me to be a more generous person for somebody who is a teacher, right? And only a teacher. And because there's a way in which, that change, that outward movement of my soul that opens me up to the world, makes me more generous, more altruistic, to me, it really comes from grace. And it has to come from grace. It's never seemed to me to be something that I could do myself.
Yeah, very, very, definitely.
And I think it unites us as well. It brings us together in this sense of solidarity. And that kind of touches on something that you write about, Father Ronald Rollheiser, which is this sense of moral loneliness. You write about the fact that a lot of us, feel lonely in ways where we think, I wish I had more friends, or I wish I was dating somebody. But that often at the root of that, or often what we really seek is a kind of moral solidarity. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, this is a concept. It's everywhere present in, for instance, if you take Catholic thought, it's in great intellectuals like Lonergan, whereas, for instance, Bernard Lonergan says when you're born, he says, you have the brand of the first principles inside your soul, Incredible. Mm-hmm. And the first principles is, God is one, true, good, and beautiful. So we are already stamped with oneness, with goodness, with beauty, and love. So when you meet him the first time, you already know what they are. The mystics used to call it the kiss of God. They say the last thing God does before God puts the soul in the body is kisses the soul, and you always remember that kiss, and then you evaluate all the kisses in the world against that kiss. But see, Kerry, then that forms what I call your moral heart. We can call it conscience, comes out of that and so on. And see, so there you already, or Henry Nouwen says, he calls that first love. You already love perfectly before you were born, and you remember that.
Right.
See, and that forms your deep moral center then. See, and that's your, when we talk about, what's all that's most precious to us and so on. See, and it's there where you want companionship. I always say more so than somebody wants somebody to sleep with, sexually or emotionally, you want somebody to sleep with morally. That, you want somebody, and our culture has a word for them where they call you're looking for your soulmate.
Right.
See, notice a soulmate, that's deeper than anything to do with the body or sex or emotions. You want somebody to meet you at the level of your soul.
Right.
That somebody who touches that kiss of God that you darkly remember.
And it's important that we allow ourselves to be touched in that way, or allow ourselves to come into consciousness of how we have been touched in that way, because that's really then where the moral law, to do good and avoid evil, begins to become intelligible to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I like all the mystical expressions and so on, but I also like Lonergan's thing about So basically, you come into the world, your soul isn't this white piece of photographic paper, tabula rasa, they used to say. Your soul is it's deeply branded with goodness, with love, with truth. And so unless we corrupt it, you know, even when we use an expression like something rings true, so I would say, well, rings true to what? If we got a little bell inside of us?
Right, right.
We do.
There's a certain
kind of a moral bell inside of you, and a love bell, and stuff rings true or rings false.
Right. There's a little anamnesis here, right? Yeah. Mm.
But it carried. It, to answer your question. See, that's where we're most deeply lonely. And you know, I think our culture expresses that in the expression of searching for your soulmate. Remember that? And it's kind of a beautiful expression. You know, it's something that's deeper than, you know, just normal friendship and, you know, even sexuality and so on. Something that's deeper. And that's our deepest loneliness.
Right. Now, you're writing this book, The Passion and the Cross, now at this time in our world and in our culture. I wonder what compelled you to kind of revisit this topic now. Was there something in the world that was happening, something inside of yourself?
You know, probably confessional. Probably more that's happening inside of myself. You know, basically I'm aging. It's a horrible way of putting it. And as you age, you know, you start looking at, you know, the periphery starts fading away, and you start saying, "What's center here? What is, what's at the deep center?" You know, I've always worked at these theoretically. I started studying John of the Cross pretty seriously in my late 20s and 30s and teaching courses and stuff and so on. And he gave me a structure, but a lot of that structure in spirituality was theoretical until, you know, I got to be 60 and had cancer twice, and a few things where that'll focus you, you know.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Right, exactly.
I could say I'm trying to save the world. Right now I'm trying to, you know, look into the mystery, partly for myself, but to share it with others.
Right. Well, because you're not alone in this aging thing. So I think it'll probably apply to a few other people.
and your journey's our journey in many ways. And the book is called The Passion and the Cross by Ronald Rollheiser. It's published by Franciscan Media, and it is out now. And, of course, you can read Father Rollheiser's work from time to time in America and all of his work in our archives. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you both for the work you do. You know, America is one of the few magazines I do cover to cover every week.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thanks so much. All right, take care.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.